Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
It still comes down to only one thing. We haven't gotten her body home. I've never been able to give her a funeral. We have a memorial stone already at the cemetery. It's down there, side of her grandmother and grandfather and side of her mother. And someday I'll be there, but getting her home and being able to say, okay, now I know where she is. But for anybody just to take a body and do whatever they did with it, to me, is absolutely insane. How can anybody with any kind of a conscience ever live with doing something like that?
On May 10th, 1986, 17-year-old Kimberly Moreau had planned to attend her high school junior prom in her hometown of Jay, Maine. She had an argument with her boyfriend Mike, and she was so upset that she refused to go to the prom. Instead, she ditched her prom plans and decided to hang out with other friends. She went out with her friend Rhonda, who grew up down the street and attended the same high school as Kimberly and her two sisters. In recent months, Kim and Rhonda had grown closer. The two girls met up with two 25-year-old male acquaintances, Brian and Darren. They cruised around that day with the men in a white Pontiac Trans Am. Kim came home around 11 p.m. that night. Her parents were working at the local VFW at the time, but she told her 19-year-old sister that she'd be back in about an hour. But Kim would never make it back home that night, and over 32 years later, she still remains missing. Kim's father, Richard, has never stopped searching for his daughter. He has one goal in mind. He just wants to find Kim. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 132 of The Vanished, Kimberly Moreau's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. At the age of 17, Kim was a junior at Jay High School, where she was a cheerleader and did gymnastics. Kim had big dreams of becoming a model. The 1980s were a different time. A time when most teens had a bit more freedom than they do today. Kim's parents felt that she was responsible, and there was no danger in their neighborhood. None of the kids ever had to worry about being out during the day or night. Here's Kim's sister Diane speaking about that time.
I never thought it was unsafe and insecure. We didn't lock our doors. We didn't worry about things like that. It wasn't something you ever thought would happen in your neighborhood. We used to walk the streets until 10 o'clock at night all the time. That was something that our parents allowed us to do because back then it wasn't something that your parents, you wouldn't think that something like that was going to happen to you. It was a total different world. You never worried about looking over your shoulder and thinking that somebody else was out there to hurt you.
Kim's parents, Richard and Patricia, went to work on the evening of the 10th at an event across the street at the local VFW. After ditching her plans for the prom, Kim and her friend Rhonda spent the afternoon and evening cruising with the two older men in the Trans Am. Around 11 p.m., Kim came through the door of the family's home. Her 19-year-old sister Karen and Karen's boyfriend Bob, now her husband, were home. Karen remembers Kim going to her room to put some of her stuff down as Bob pulled the curtain back to see a white Pontiac Trans Am idling out front. Kim then came back out saying that she was going for a ride and would be back in about an hour. She didn't say who she was with, and Karen didn't ask, something that she's beat herself up about ever since that night. But she really had no reason to question her sister. She simply thought she'd be back in an hour. Karen was 19 and Kim 17. She had no reason to worry about what might happen that night. When she stopped by, Kim seemed normal. In fact, when Karen had seen her earlier in the day, she seemed fine. She was upset about her boyfriend. They knew that, but she still seemed okay. She left her purse and her jacket. But what they weren't aware of at the time, though, was that the group she was with had allegedly been drinking and using cocaine that night. Karen warned Kim that she better be home before her parents got back. Only Kim never came home, and her family never saw her again. According to Richard, the car was owned by one of the two men, Darren, who was Rhonda's boyfriend at the time. But no one knows who was in the car when it pulled up to the family's home. Unfortunately, the three who had been with Kim that night have never had consistent stories about what happened.
Kimberly left the house and she was with a friend of hers, Rhonda Breton, who is now dead. She turned around and she left the house and they went downtown and Rhonda's boyfriend come by with a brand new car. They got in and went riding around with him all day. There was another guy with him. The girls got in the back seat. The guys were in the front seat and they went riding. We now know that, unfortunately, there was some drugs got involved. They also got into having some kind of liquor. I don't know if it was beer or hard stuff or what, but there was some. So, supposedly, the owner of the car, who was Darren Jodry, turned around and he ended up supposedly going to work that night. So they brought him to work up to Rumford, which is 27 miles from here. They showed up back down here at the house that night about 20 minutes of 11. At that point, Kim came in the house, saw her sister, and she went into the bathroom, put all her personal things on the bed. She left her jacket and everything. It was 38 degrees that night. And she left and she came back out, told her sister, "I'll be back in an hour."
When Kim's parents got home from the VFW around 1:30 a.m., they checked on Kim, only to find that she wasn't home. This wasn't like her. They decided to give it a little bit more time to see if she'd return.
5 o'clock in the morning, I looked at my wife and I said, "Something's definitely wrong. She has never, ever done this." I said, "We better go to the police station." At that point, they told us that we couldn't report her missing for at least 48 hours. Which we now know is not so, but that's the way it is back then.
So without help from the police, the family felt as though they were on their own. Family, friends, and other community members came together and began looking for Kim. They went to the places they thought Kim might be and tracked down Rhonda and the two guys. From the very first day, the police believed that Kim had run away. But no one in Kim's family believed that was a possibility. Kim's sister Diane spoke about how frustrating those first 48 hours were for their family.
It was very, very frustrating. It was like nobody was listening to anything we were saying. They have to wait 48 hours. She was a 17-year-old girl. We shouldn't have had to wait 48 hours to report her missing. It was very frustrating for the family. We were trying to do all the legwork, trying to contact her friends, different people, asking if they had seen her. And no, everybody kept telling us, no. And not knowing what to do and why we had to wait the length of time.
First of all, Kim's family was adamant that she would have never run away without her things. Without her makeup, her clothes, her purse, or her car.
If you had ever known my daughter was so prim and proper. If you came here and it was 11 o'clock in the morning and her hair wasn't absolutely perfect and she didn't have her makeup on or whatever, she wouldn't talk to you. She wouldn't even come out of the room and talk to you until she was all dressed up and absolutely proper. Now, Kim was 5'7". She weighed 135 pounds. She was going into the Miss Maine Beauty pageant. And she was going to be a model. She had already done interviews with a modeling agency in Boston.
The family had to go out and find people who had been with Kim that night and question them themselves. Here's Kim's sister, Karen.
We did determine who they were because we knew that Kim was with Rhonda that day. And we found out in asking around and so forth that Darren and Brian were with her. Me and my husband, who was just a boyfriend then, went and contacted one of the guys. We tracked him down. We tracked down Rhonda. We did our best to try to get straightforward answers, and we weren't getting them. Everybody was changing stories. One of the men that was with her tried to deny it at first, that he didn't even know Kim. And then when we said, yes, you did, you were with Rhonda, and the next words out of his mouth were, oh, was that her name? He ended up peeling out of the parking lot, squealing tire, just being a complete asshole. Sorry, but that fully describes what he was.
Since Karen and Bob had only seen the Trans Am from inside the house, they couldn't tell who was in the car. The three other people's stories weren't consistent enough to determine that, but Brian has admitted that he was in the car. And it's possible that Darren was also. But if Rhonda's to be believed, Darren went to work and then she went home. That would leave only Brian in the car at the time that Kimberly was picked up. But it's not clear enough to say for sure. They did, however, go to talk to Rhonda.
We can only speculate. We can't prove we weren't there, and that's one of the biggest problems because we didn't go to the car. We were in the house. My parents weren't home, and me and Bob were sitting on the couch, and we did not get up and go out. So we can't prove 100%. We know what we feel. We know what we believe, but we cannot prove it. Bob agrees. We talked to her a day or two after. Rhonda tried to say that they split and went different ways. And I'll put it this way. Over a period of time, she changed stories.
And the guy's stories kept changing too.
There were a number of different things. She was dropped off at the bottom of Jewel Street to walk home, came from one of the guys, which we know was a complete hoax because Kim was afraid of the dark. And I know that for a fact because I used to scare Kim. I'd come in and jump her and it would take nothing. Or for her to walk home from a neighbor's house, they would both stand out by the side of the road. Each would get their own driveway and then run in and say goodnight. I mean, she just didn't go anywhere at night on her own. She had somebody else with her.
When Kim disappeared, she was described as 5'7" tall and about 135 pounds. She had blonde, wavy, shoulder-length hair, blue eyes, 4 piercings in her left ear, 3 piercings in the right. She had a surgical scar on her back and healed fractures of the arm and ankle. The old fractures are important because they're distinguishable features. which can be positive signs when identifying bones if they're ever found. Kim was wearing a white blouse, blue jeans, and white high-top sneakers. She also had her boyfriend Mike's men's class ring engraved with Mike 87 and Mike Staples. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. You aren't sleeping and you're stressed out. That's how it was for me, so I cleared out my cabinet and reset my health with CBD from CB Distillery. Their deep sleep gummies are amazing. CB Distillery's targeted formulations are made from the highest quality clean ingredients. No fluff, no fillers, just pure, effective CBD solutions designed to help support your health. In two non-clinical surveys, 81% of customers experienced more calm, 80% said CBD helped with pain after physical activity, and an impressive 90% said they slept better with CBD. If you struggle with a health concern and haven't found relief, make the change to CB Distillery. And with over 2 million customers and a solid 100% money-back guarantee, CB Distillery is a source to trust. I have a 20% discount to get you started. Visit cbdistillery.com and use code VANISHED for 20% off. That's cbdistillery.com, code VANISHED. cbdistillery.com. The police had told Kim's family that they needed to wait 48 hours to report her missing. After searching on their own and not getting any answers from the three who had been with her, Richard went back to the police.
We waited 48 hours, went back to report her as being missing, told them we wanted her listed on the NCIC computer. They made a phone call. Unfortunately, when they made the phone call, it was to the sheriff's department. They were having a very busy night. The guy took down the information, threw it on a desk. It got put underneath some papers and never did get listed for 4.5 months later. We ended up, in the meantime, at that time back in 86, you had to pay for any phone calls within that was outside of a 10-mile radius. So we were spending anywhere from $600 to $1,000 a month. And unfortunately, it never happened until 4.5 months later. The one thing we did do is we documented every single call we ever made, who we talked to, the time we talked to them, and what was said. At the time, Kim's mother was dying of cancer.
Over the years, Richard has been diligent about documenting all the stories that have been told about the night his daughter disappeared.
Well, one has changed the story 3 different times. He picked her up. They picked her up, supposedly, and when she left here, now we'll take it from the time she left here. From the time she left here when she told her sister, and this was about 11 o'clock at night, that she'd be back in an hour. Supposedly, according to him, it started off, they went and they dropped Rhonda off at her house. They went out and they had consensual sex. Now, that's what he says. Then the next thing he says, I says, okay, what time was that? Well, that was at 1 o'clock. Okay, where did you drop her off? And dropped her off at the back. Well, that's down in the village. And supposedly dropped her off there. Then the next thing I knew, well, they went down to a different place. They went over to another place and they went down there. And he ended up, again, He stresses consensual sex. I mean, he really stresses that consensual. Then supposedly he was dropping her off at 4 o'clock in the morning. Then the next thing I know, he's dropping her off at 1:15 in the morning in a total different place. I told him right to his face, I says, you know, that's all fine and good. I says, I ain't going to say that didn't happen. But I says, how the hell could you drop her off at 3 different places? And I says, the other thing is, I says, you're a damn liar. And just the way I told him. Because I says, first of all, Kim was, I says, you didn't know it, but Kim was totally afraid of the dark. She wouldn't even go next door to go visit her grandmother and grandfather, who lived only about 250 feet from where we did, without coming home and calling and say, turn the light on, I'm coming home and somebody watch for me. So I says, your story about that, I says, is bull. The other thing is, I says, it was 38 degrees. She had on only a short sleeve blouse. I says, she wouldn't be outside with only a short sleeve blouse and want to walk over a half a mile home because she was distraught about her boyfriend turning around and having been caught in bed with her girlfriend. I says, your whole story, I says, is a crap, and it's a bunch of crap. I says, it's that simple. So he looked at me and he says, what will it take to make you happy? I says, well, I says, I can tell you, I says, if I was in your shoes, I says, and this here was 17 years after Kim had disappeared. I says, if I was in your shoes, I says, I'd be doing every doggone thing I could to clear my name. And I says, you haven't done one single thing. Well, he says, what'll make you happy? You want me to take a lie detector test? I says, well, that'd be a start. I says, if you can pass it. Well, he says, I'll go ahead and do that. And I call a detective right then and says, okay, here he is, talk to him. He says, he'll do it. It's just always been so much contradiction on everything that has gone on around that case. And it always seems that we're always fighting to try to get help. And communication is nothing. You get nothing out of the police. Absolutely crap. I've only had, in 32 years, 2 detectives that has ever communicated.
Both of the guys known to be in the Trans Am with Kim that night took lie detector tests. And as far as Richard is aware, neither of them passed. Kim's boyfriend Mike was questioned and has been cleared by the police. The family just didn't buy the story that Kim would walk alone at night, nor would she ask to walk in the cold. According to Brian Edman, at Kim's request, he dropped her off on the side of the street, a half mile from her home. He admitted that he and Darren rode around, drank alcohol, and did cocaine together on the night of Kim's disappearance. But he insists that he dropped her off alone and that she had told him she didn't want to go home. At a later point when police spoke to Brian, they described him as cooperative. Richard has his own theory about what happened that night.
The feeling I got out of it, and this was me, Marissa, is that he was trying to say that they had sex and that she had agreed to it. And I think it's the other way around. I think he said, we spent all this money today on riding you around and so forth. You're paying me something. I think that's what happened. And be honest with you, the other thing if I had to guess, I would say what happened when she left here, and this is only my conjunction, is that she went out with him. They had done drugs during the day. I know that she was classified as a social user now. I never knew it then. I think the combination of the drugs that she did then and the liquor, whatever it was, between that and the two, and I think when she left here, he turned around and he slipped her some more drugs. And I think she started to OD. And that's when he tried to take advantage of her or one thing or another. And that's where the consensual sex comes in. That's my gut feeling. He turns around and he starts in while she starts to fight him off, and whatever happened, happened. You know, I don't know what happened. We can put any scenario we want to it, but where he stresses consensual sex so hard, to me, it was something he tried to force himself on her, and she was fighting him, and something happened. He probably hit back against her. She fell back, hit her head. I don't know. Maybe he turned around and attacked her. I don't know. I haven't got a clue.
Because Kim's case wasn't considered a homicide, state police didn't get involved right away. They still believe that Kim had just ran away and didn't take the family's insistence that something terrible had happened, that possibly this was a homicide. Kim's family continued researching and investigating on their own. Here's Karen talking about asking Kim's workplace to put up a missing poster when she first disappeared.
Kim worked at McDonald's. When Kim went missing, we made up posters, and I brought one into McDonald's and asked them to put it on the board. And do you know that the manager of McDonald's told us no? They wouldn't do it, that they felt it was hanging up a sign just like a advertising for a yard sale or anything else. They didn't feel it was important enough. I was so ticked off that I wrote to the Ronald McDonald House, and I told them what I thought. This is how you treat your employees? She's missing, and you won't even hang up a poster? Gee, I got a phone call after writing that letter asking me to please bring one to the establishment, that they would gladly hang it. It shouldn't have taken that. We just felt that every time we turned around, it was another slap in the face of somebody else not wanting to help. We just felt that everybody wanted to sweep it under the rug.
Richard would get calls, sometimes from people late at night, anonymous calls. The voices on the other end telling him, "We know what happened to your daughter." None of these calls ever led anywhere. Kim's parents were desperate.
Well, come to find out, the chief of police at the time, there was a problem with him. He didn't want the full story of what was going on there come out because of some other stuff that was going on in his life at the time.
According to Kim's sister Karen, at the time, the chief of police had another reason for wanting Kim's disappearance to be only viewed as a runaway case.
My mother was so desperate that she wrote a letter to the president. The president at the time was Ronald Reagan, begging for help because we went over and over and over to the Jay Police Department. And the police chief at the time kept saying that Kim was a runaway. Do you know back in 1986, he prevented us from getting Kim's story on the news? He stopped it. He stopped us from getting it in the media, whether it be newspapers, whether it be television. And he would totally come on and tell everybody, no, she's a runaway. Don't air that story. When we finally get the media to take us seriously, he had cops telling them she was a runaway. He also threatened policemen on his watch, stating that he would fire them if they pursued looking for Kim. He said not a nickel would be spent of taxpayers' money looking for Kim. Oh, it's because he had a son at the time who was dealing drugs, and he was chief of police, and there was a party at his house that night. And he didn't want it out that he had minors at his house drinking and doing drugs, and he wanted to protect his own ass. He wanted to save his reputation, He didn't care about Kim. I hope she haunts him. We know that multiple people that were at the party hung out with us and were our age group and were in the same clique, more or less. But we can't prove Kim was there that night.
The frustrations the family felt got them nowhere.
After you go through all these hurt and all these different phases that you go through, I mean, the first place you start is the anxiety the night of whatever happens, happens. Now you put your faith in, who would you put your faith in? Naturally, if not knowing anything, you put your faith in the police, the ones that's supposed to be there protecting you and helping you. Then you find out that this guy here is backstabbing you all the way. Every time that I'd finally get somebody to come over to do an interview or a news item or something. Of course, they'd leave us. They run to the police. Who the heck are they going to believe, us or the police? The chief kept saying, oh, she's a runaway. She's done this before. Well, she had never run away. She lived the summer before. She lived in Farmington, which is 18 miles from here. And she had a job up there, and she was living with some friends of hers, and she was here. She was in touch with her mother at least 5 days a week, if not more. So we're getting all these counter stories coming back, and that's what kept delaying it, delaying it, delaying it.
For Kim's sister Karen, who had spoken to her the night she disappeared, she's had moments where she's blamed herself for not stopping Kim from leaving that evening.
When Kim first went missing, we were in total distress. I mean, my family life was pure hell. We had no idea. We were just in a cloud, more or less. And as things went on little by little, I got to the point of, I talked to Kim that night. Why didn't I ask more questions? Why? Why didn't I stop her? What, you know? And you go through that. And then you get to the point of, okay, now I'm just angry at the world because you took my sister in. Nobody's helping. And then I got to the point of, okay, was this like a personal hit on Kim? And we, at least I felt, everybody's looking at my family all of a sudden, because I had complete strangers asking me questions, if I knew where my sister was, if anything had been resolved or whatever. And then you kind of get to the point of, you're scared, because now you don't know who it is. Am I talking to the killer? I'm looking in my back seat to make sure nobody's there. I'm watching over my shoulder. I went in Walmart one day, and somebody that had been known as a drug dealer and knew Rhonda and so forth confronted me in Walmart. And I was just doing my shopping, having an everyday day, and all of a sudden started asking me questions and really drilling me. And I finally got to the point that you need to get away from me or I'm going to scream, because I'm very uncomfortable. I'm feeling very violated, and I really felt frightened because I'm now to the point that, oh my God, every sense on me is just wrong. Nobody understands, unless they've been in the situation that we have, how much it can impact your life.
When police searched Kim's belongings, they found some pills in her purse. For Karen, these pills were common for teens to take back then in an attempt to stay thin. But what concerned Karen was what happened to those pills.
The night that Kim went missing, purse was at the house, her makeup was at the house, her clothing was at the house. Kim wanted to be a model. Kim would not have left all of these items at home. She had a car that my parents bought her. Kim's purse had pills in it. I will tell you, they were little white pills. They were called Crossroads. And you could get them at high school for a quarter apiece. It was speed. Girls at that time used those for dieting to stay thin. Police made such a big deal out of this. So they took the pills and they were going to analyze them. And let's just say with all of the trouble that we were having with police not doing their jobs and not following through, my parents were making notes of absolutely everything that was provided to police. When the pills got turned in, they basically went into evidence. They kept being asked, what were they? What were they? And my parents didn't know. And I was 20 years old at the time. Kim was 17. I didn't want to pipe up and say, I know what they are. Because police were like all over us. We didn't want to put ourselves in any more speculation. Looking at us, we wanted them to focus on Kim. When the pills finally supposedly got returned to my parents and the state police, we could understand if they would have taken them and analyzed them and crushed up one. And when they got them back, there were more pills than what they started. So, pills don't reproduce.
It took about 4.5 months for the state police to take what the family was saying seriously. Kim's mom had cancer. She was battling to find her daughter and worried her own life would end before she got any answers. Even having Kim registered as a missing person was a fight.
We had called so many people in the state. I mean, we tried the governor, everybody. And we had called so many people that finally the state decided that they would send a detective, but understanding that only happens if the local police agree to it. We even tried the FBI, couldn't get them involved. The U.S. Marshals tried to get them. You can't get them involved because you got to have the okay from the local police to start with. The FBI and the marshals, and it's now got to be a federally. It's got to be a federal thing that they get involved in, crossing state lines and all this kind of thing. Well, we didn't have proof that any of that happened. So we had to stay with the state. When the detective came in, he sat down, what he never expected. There was three of us sitting here. It was my wife, my sister, and myself. And we had pamphlets all made up of every doggone documentation on every single phone call, everything that had been done all the way through up until that point. In the end, the whole doggone thing, he turned around and he looked at us. He says, I want to tell you something. He says, I came through that door this morning, and he says, because he spent about 10 hours here that day. He says, I came through that door figuring I was coming in to have a cup of coffee to appease you, and turned around, I was walking out. He says, after sitting here listening to everything that's gone on and looking at everything, he says, I now believe that she is definitely a missing individual. And that's when he called up the sheriff's office, and we found out she had never even been listed on the NCIC computer as missing.
You're probably wondering about that Trans Am. Was there ever any evidence recovered from the car? Was it even processed back then? Well, I'll tell you, the car wasn't examined until many years after Kim disappeared.
They did a visual about 3 months after Kim went disappeared. They let it go 3 months before they ever went and did a visual. Back then, we didn't have DNA testing like you get today. So they never did that. We did finally do that, but it was like 18 years later. And then it turned out, what I got the biggest kick out of is when they told me that they They couldn't find the car. I says, wait a minute. You are a state detective. We have a motor vehicle department. You've got the VIN number of the damn thing. You mean to say you can't call the motor vehicle department and find out where that car is? Oh. Gee, miraculously, about a week later, yeah, we found the car. It was sitting 30 miles away from here. There'd been two previous owners besides the one that had the car, and the one that had the car was a town officer in Rumford. I mean, this is the kind of stupidity I've had to deal with as well. Didn't come up with anything. This year, 17 years later, it's pretty doggone hard. Your chances of ever finding anything other than maybe finding blood would have been almost nil.
Kim's family always suspected that her friend Rhonda knew more than she was saying, but Rhonda always maintained that she didn't know anything.
Always felt she knew, and that she turned around and ran away from it. She ended up, after Kim disappeared, she said, well, we knew each other, but we weren't really very close. Well, that's a whole crock of bull, because the two of them were like two peas in a pod for the last 7 months Kim was alive. Let me give you a little background with her. She ended up, after Kim disappeared, this girl ended up moving away from here. She moved 30 miles away. She became an alcoholic. She went from being an alcoholic to a drug addict. She moved back in the area, and then she left the area again and moved to Florida. And she ended up finally getting cleaned up. Next thing we knew, she was out in California. She got busted in California for forging checks. Spent 18 months in jail. She had two kids. She ended up losing the kids to the state, was in the process of getting the kids back when she turned around and violated her parole and got put back in jail, so that delayed the kids. In the meantime, her sister died of cancer, and she never came home to her own sister's funeral.
Jay is a small town, and over the years, Richard has run into those who he thinks are involved in his daughter's disappearance, and some who he feels might just know more. Rhonda's family lived only up the street, and Richard felt like there was some tension there.
Later on in years, I would see her mother, who, because they only lived a short ways from where we did, I would see her mother, and her mother felt so uneasy when she walked down the street that she'd actually cross the street and go on the opposite side if I was outside. So one day, I watched her coming down, and I stayed back, and then I approached her, and I said, I think you and I need to sit down and have a little talk. I said, I'd like to really talk to you. I says, I know you feel very, very uneasy about what's going on. I'm just trying to tell you, I hold no animosity towards anybody. I have nothing against you. Whatever your daughter was involved in didn't mean that you were the one that was involved in it. And I says, we can't go back and change any of that. But I says, we can change the fact that if we walk in, happen to be in the same room, that there is such uneasiness in there that you can't be comfortable. And I did the same thing with her brother. They aren't the one that were involved, so, you know, why should that be that way? And he's turned out that he and I are very good friends today.
About 10 years ago, Rhonda died in a hit-and-run accident in California. She did manage to get herself cleaned up before she died, and she was in the process of getting her kids back. Some speculate that she struggled to cope with what happened to Kim. Maybe it was that she was running away from what she did know. From Richard's understanding, Rhonda wanted to come back to Maine shortly before her death. He believes someone was worried about Rhonda coming back, that maybe she would talk.
Personally, my gut feel is, I think she got fed up with the whole thing and says, you know what, I'm coming home, I've had enough of this here. I'm coming home, and that's going to be the way it is. And my own gut feel is, somebody took a ride out to California because it was a hit-and-run accident, mysteriously, just a short while later.
2 years after Kim disappeared, her mom, Patricia, lost her battle with cancer. She died not knowing what happened to Kim and no closer to bringing her home. She had already been diagnosed before Kim had disappeared and continued treatment through the long days of searching for answers. One thing Richard promised Patricia was that he would never stop searching for their daughter. Patricia is buried in Holy Cross Cemetery in Livermore Falls. Right alongside her gravestone is another one with Kimberly Moreau's name on it. And on the other side is a plot for Richard.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
They Walk Among Us is an award-winning true crime podcast. From the sinister and surreal to the brutal and bizarre, join us to hear more on the UK's most notorious and obscure crimes. Featuring well-known cases like the life and crimes of the UK's most violent inmate, Charles Bronson, to the sad tale of the Gibbons twins whose string of petty crimes would lead them to be trapped in Broadmoor for 11 years before their eventual release ended in tragedy. We also cover lesser-known cases like the woman who murdered a husband with an ornamental frog and kept him mummified in her shed for 18 years, or the teenager that used his elaborate online fantasy life to plot his own murder. Listen and subscribe to They Walk Among Us through Acast, Apple Podcasts, or your favourite podcast provider.
Kim's sister Diane spoke about wanting answers and not being afraid to ask those people who last saw her sister.
My father and I years ago had a sit-down meeting at his house with Brian Edmonds, face-to-face. Because at the time when my sister disappeared, I was bartending, or shortly after my sister disappeared, I was bartending. And I used to try to get one of my friends who knew them to bring them in because I never knew who these people were. And I used to try to get them to come in, and they would not come into the bar to speak to me. And I said, why? And they said, because I was afraid of you. And I said, you should be. But we did have a meeting with him, and he denied it to our face and just told me that basically back then he was afraid of me. And I said, it doesn't matter if it's back then or now. You should still be afraid of me. But he would not tell us where she was or anything else because he was covering up for the other guy. Like, that's what they do.
In 1993, Kimberly was legally declared deceased. Over the years, the family received tips, and they know the police have too. Many years ago, Kim's sister Karen was contacted to meet with the Attorney General. This meeting gave them hope that eventually led to more frustration.
I went with my father. After I went before the legislative board, I ended up getting a few of the people there that listened and actually contacted the Attorney General. So I was at work one day and got a personal phone call inviting me to go talk to the Attorney General, who was Bill Stokes at the time. And you know, I went to Augusta and I invited Dad, and Dad went. we got there, and there was the attorney general, and there were several cops there. We spent almost 6 hours in Augusta that day. When we left there, we were told that they were going to do a search and that they knew where her body was. That's what cops said. Do you know that to this date, that search has never been done? And I corresponded with the attorney general by email several times after. And they kept saying, oh, it's going to happen. Police just need to organize everybody. And then it was, and I was also told that day, they had plenty of evidence to be able to obtain a search warrant. And then lo and behold, after all of that, it magically, oh, they couldn't get the search warrant. That's, oh, well, we'll move on to something else. And that was the end of that. That was 11 years ago.
More recently, a man contacted the family with some information. Diane hoped that this lead would pay off.
We actually had a gentleman last year that was a friend of ours from high school, came over and sat down and talked to us and said he had information that he thought was pertinent to the case and proceeded to give us a little bit of the details. And we told him, and, you know, he said that he wanted us to call the policeman and tell him what was going on. We told him that if we brought it to the police, that it was going to be washed under the rug, and we thought it would be better off if he brought it up to them. He was a truck driver and was going out of town, and he said when he got back, he was going to make sure that he went over and talked to them. I don't know if they ever, ever pursued anything. I know that he did go speak to them, but I don't think they ever pursued going to look into what he came to us with about. So still to this day, I believe that we're giving them tips and leads and people are coming forth and they're still washing it under the rug.
In 2013, Darren, who was Rhonda's boyfriend and with Kim the night she disappeared, he was arrested on drug trafficking charges after a cocaine bust in Mexico, Maine. Over the course of the year prior to the bust, undercover agents had purchased cocaine off of the four men, including Darren. Darren was arrested and bail was set at $3,000. According to Kim's sisters, they received word at this time that Darren was going to talk, that he was prepared to give up information that he knew about Kim's disappearance as a deal.
Darren was caught dealing drugs in a school zone, so he was going to be going away for a very long time, and he had it all rigged up that he was going to get out of jail free, basically, in order to give up what happened to Kim, and he was ready to make the deal. His lawyer came in, told him basically to shut his mouth, and got him off all charges, free and clear. He never spent one day in jail for dealing cocaine in a school zone. So you tell me the kind of pull this gentleman has with the world. Anybody else would have been sitting in jail rotting their lives away, but his lawyer got him off. And if I'm correct, I believe he got a $1,000 fine. Well, big deal. I'm sure dealing coke, he makes a whole lot more than $1,000.
Richard has put up thousands of signs all over Western Maine on telephone poles, trees, signposts, and store windows. He's covered ground where he believes she might be buried. He's searched swamps, wells, and forests with metal detectors, hoping that any piece of metal from her clothing might trigger something. With no answers, Richard and some other families were able to push to get a cold case unit established in 2015.
Yes, we formed a group of families. A group of families got together, and we went down to the state legislature, and we got down there, and we petitioned them to get the cold case going. We finally got some money approved through the legislature for the cold case. Well, we don't feel that the money has been used in the right manner. All they've done is they displaced detectives from one spot, put them into a so-called cold case squad, but they keep pulling them off of that and doing all active cases. So to say we're working with a cold case squad, it's a very part-time thing. We want full-time detectives working on it. And that's why they wanted some people to go down to Augusta. Well, I've had to fight and argue and talk and everything to get help to try to get Kim home ever since this has started. Well, they kind of elected me to be the spokesman for the group and go down there because some people cannot discuss that case whatsoever. If they try to do it, they all break down and every other thing. Well, I've had to do it for so long that it's I just continue to do it. I'll do whatever I can. And the way I feel that most of the things that we're fighting for, you know, like in a wrongful death, it used to be that you had 2 years to make up your mind if you wanted to sue an individual or not. Well, now it's 6 years. We got that change. We've had the cold case squad started, and that supposedly was going to be a big light for a lot of us. And that's turned out to be a real sad thing in many ways. So that's the things that's going on, and that's the things we're trying to change. And in the meantime, I'm trying to get my daughter home.
Up until 2015, police had conducted over 10 large-scale searches for Kim's remains. Test samples had been obtained from a property owned by one of those who saw Kim that night, but nothing positive had shown up. In 2015, the family heard that a property in Canton, Maine was to be searched. Police had obtained a search warrant for the property belonging to Brian Enman. He had purchased the property and a lot adjacent to it back in 2000, but Karen told us that he always had ties to the land, even back then. The family believed that the answers they had all been waiting for were coming. The fact that the police had a search warrant made it seem all the more real. Enman, who was by then 54, was not on the property during the search, but when asked for a comment, said that he fully understood that the state police had a job to do. He also stated that he had nothing to do with Kim's disappearance.
The state got some information. I still don't know what it was. Whatever it was, they went to see a judge, turned around, got all the proper paperwork, and did a search on one of the prime suspect's properties. The only thing I can tell you is that dogs kept hitting on human remains, and that's as much as I know. They never found anything. We used ground-penetrating radar. We used the dogs out there. We were out there for a total of 4 days. When I say we, the police and everybody were out there for a period of 4 days. I was not allowed on the property.
Geology professors from the University of Maine, together with the state police and cadaver dogs, went over the five-acre property and identified five locations as possible search sites for human remains. Ground-penetrating radar was used to identify areas of soil that had been disturbed, even decades prior. They also looked for deviations in the surface levels, where areas may dip, indicating a possible gravesite. With these types of burials, once they're dug and filled in, they never really level off the same as it was before and can create depressions or small hills. In the five locations, backhoes were used to break up the soil so that any gases trapped under the earth from human remains could be picked up by the dogs. According to the University of Maine's geology department, who were contacted for this episode, ground-penetrating radar is a standard technique used in searching for clandestine burials. While ground-penetrating radar does not directly image skeletons or bodies, the technique can often identify the disturbed sediments associated with a grave. That said, there can be any number of legitimate causes of ground disturbance. This is why working with cadaver dogs is so powerful. The dog provides a second line of information to determine if an excavation is warranted. Maine State Police and the Oxford County Sheriff's Office searched for 4 days. The family was not allowed on site, but remained as near to the property as they could, waiting for any news from the police. Police were confident and told the family that this could be it. Only it wasn't. nothing was found. A search was planned for the adjacent plot of land, and Detective Sergeant Mark Holmquist of the Maine State Police Major Crimes Unit spoke to the media, saying that he would not rule out Brian Enman as a possible future suspect. He said they were not ruling anyone in or out. They confirmed that the case wasn't classified as a homicide, but they did suspect foul play. According to the press, another search was conducted later that month in Jay. The exact location was not disclosed to the public, and it's understood that this search also proved fruitless. There's a big difference in this case compared to many other cases of the missing. Kim's father, Richard, has kept in contact with one person whom he believes knows what happened to his daughter that night. He stays in contact with Brian Enman. Richard talks to him periodically and lets Brian know that he believes he knows more. He's begged him to let them know where Kim's body is, even if he just submits an anonymous tip. It's important to add here that Enman has never been officially classified by police as a suspect, nor has he ever been charged with any offense in relation to the disappearance of Kimberly Moreau. When questioned, he maintains his innocence, that he has no knowledge as to Kim's whereabouts. He also openly admits that he understands that the police are just doing their job.
I have, through the course of the years, talked with this individual that owns it. He turns around and he has never once ever denied not knowing whatever happened to Kim. Not even once. Not that we can ever find anybody. If you look at him in the face and you're talking to him, I've had him sitting right here in the house, and I told him right to his face, I says, you and I both know you're a doggone liar, because whatever happened to Kim happened to her. I ain't saying it was intentional, but it did happen to her. And unfortunately, you know where she is, and you won't tell us. I know he's taking lie detector tests. I also know that the individual, no matter how many times you talk to him, he'll look at you straight in the face until you mention Kim's name, and then his head just drops, and then after that he's fumbling around with buttons or something on his shirt or something he's got in his pocket or something like that, but he'll never look at you straight in the face again.
Besides the two men that we know were with Kim the night she disappeared, Richard has always suspected another man in town, a man with a dangerous past. Although he doesn't have any proof of this man's involvement, he has ties to the crowd she was running with.
He wanted to go out with my daughter. He wanted to go out with her, and my daughter didn't want nothing to do with him because he's a real scum of the earth. He turned around, and we know that he was involved in doing drugs. He would get these young high school kids. He'd start them up on drugs, get them hooked onto drugs. Well, he didn't care if it was a boy or a girl. He liked his little sexual favors. And he would force them to do sexual favors in order for him to get what he wanted. The same guy turned around and almost beat a man to death because the guy went over and told him, stay the hell away from his daughter. He took a baseball bat, and this guy ended up in the hospital for 4 months. He ended up spending 18 months in jail for it, got released. Another girl, before he did that one, he was involved in a car accident. There was a girl that got hurt in a car accident, and rather than take it to a hospital, he wanted to just torture right there in the car. The girl died during the night because she bled to death because they didn't take it to the hospital. I mean, this guy here is cold-hearted to a point. The guy has no conscience. Had a game warden that told him to get out of this certain area where they were because people that owned the place didn't want them there. He turned around and started giving the game warden a hard time. The game warden put cuffs on him. He turned around and actually bit the game warden in the face and turned around and took a chunk of skin out. So this guy is very sadistic, and we know that he was a drug dealer down around the area. So, and that's where the two guys that Kim was with that day, Darren, he was the drug pusher up around the Canton area. And Brian was his little flunky that always turned around and drove him around. So Darren liked being the big boss. And Darren was the one that always had the water money and drove the new car, had a new car and all of this. So that's how they all were connected.
Today, it has been more than 32 years since Kim disappeared. That's 11,766 days that her family has been searching for answers and wondering what happened on that chilly May night. Richard is still pressing on, and tips are still coming in.
Here we are 32 years later. The biggest problems that we have is any time that you get a lead, in order to get state police involved, it takes so much time. There's a search that should have been done last fall. We're still sitting here waiting for it to get done. Hasn't been done. Some new information came up this spring. It's been sitting there. Nothing has been done yet. They keep giving us the same thing. Well, we've got to work on these active cases that's going on. I'm saying, well, we have gone to the state and we had started a cold case squad. Well, they keep pulling them off the cold cases to put them on active cases. So we're going to try to go back to the state again to see about getting some full-time detectives that do nothing but work on cold cases. But like I said, we got a search that should have been done last October. Here we are in July. Still isn't done. How long is long enough? How long is a family supposed to wait for them to get their fingers out and start doing their job? And that's what we're going to be fighting for again. We're busy. That's what we always get. We're busy. We're too busy. We can't organize it.
Kim's sisters are also frustrated with the promises of searches and promises of search warrants being obtained. They're tired of feeling like Kim's case doesn't matter.
They want it washed under the rug and they want us to stop bugging them about it. Well, guess what? We're not going to stop bugging them. We're just going to keep pursuing and keep pursuing. And each time a new family member of ours passes away, guess what? That just means we bug him even more.
Richard doesn't want revenge. He's not even asking for a prosecution. He just wants his daughter found.
And be honest with you, if she is ever found and anybody goes to court, I will not be there, because the only thing I'll do is raise up a lot more emotions that I've already dealt with once. I don't need to deal with them again. I have even gone to the district attorney and asked that if somebody came forward with the information that actually produced the body, that they would get total dispensation. And they said no. Said, if a crime has been committed, you got to prosecute it. And I says, that's bull. I says, if you can get one person on it, why not take one? One is better than you're doing.
But it's different for Kim's sisters and Bob. They appreciate their father's wishes just to bring Kim home, to give her the burial that she deserves. But they also want justice. They want the person responsible for either killing Kim or hiding what happened to her. They want that person to be held accountable, to pay for what they have done and the anguish and heartache caused to all of those who loved Kim.
I want our closure, and I want someone to rot in hell for what they put us through all of these years. I'm not like my father. My father just wants her found, and that's it. He doesn't want revenge. I, on the other hand, think Kim needs justice, and I want somebody to have to pay for what they did. They took my sister from me. I think somebody should have to go to jail. I think somebody should have to own up to it. They obviously don't have a conscience, but I'd like the law to actually be able to prosecute and put somebody in jail for it. Having somebody die from cancer, it's hard, believe me. Having my mother gone was horrible. But having Kim taken from us the way that she was is a whole different ballgame. We knew what happened to Mom. We don't know what happened to Kim, and that's not right. No family should have to go through that.
As far as answers go, Kim's family will continue searching, and they feel as though there are people out there who are well aware of what those answers are. They just need to take that step and end this for her family.
And my feeling is, well, we don't know where the answer is going to come from, but all it's going to take is one person to hear it and something, hear it or see it or something that's going to touch them off, and then maybe this will all come to an end.
This is just my personal belief. I believe Kim is dead. There was no doubt in my mind because she would not have just disappeared from the family and not come back. But I don't feel that she can truly be at peace and cross over and be happy with her missing. I feel that she's still out there somewhere saying, "Find me." And I don't think she can truly be at peace.
Bringing Kim home is the most important thing there is. I want to do it not only for my two daughters that remain, but I want to do it for everybody in this community and everybody around the country and even around the world that Kim is finally home, and for everybody that ever said a prayer for her. In the end, we're all going to stand in front of our Maker, and we're all going to answer for everything we have done in our lives. And the way I look at it, he'll be able to deal out a much better punishment than anybody else does. And I can say this, knowing the people that's involved in Kim's case, seeing the lives that they've all led to this point, I would not change 1 minute of my life for theirs. No matter what I've gone through. 86, I lost Kim. 87, I lost my father. He died. My wife, my first wife was dying of cancer, and she died in 88. And now I've lost my second wife, I've lost a stepson, I've had so many losses in my life, but I would not change my lives for theirs, no matter what. I still have a much better life than they will ever have.
So what happened to Kimberly Moreau on May 10th, 1986, after she left in that Trans Am around 11 p.m.? One of the men she was with claimed that he dropped her off about a half mile away from her home in the very early morning hours of May 11th. But it was cold out, and Kim only had on a short-sleeved shirt. Kim was also terrified of the dark. If she did get dropped off, where did she go? Or is that just a story, and she was never dropped off after all? Looking at Kim's case, it's easy to imagine being in the mindset of a 17-year-old girl and hanging out with these older guys in their cool car. At 17, we all felt like we were grown up, that we could handle these kinds of situations. But something happened to Kim that night. Was this a case, as Richard suspects, of a couple naive teens being supplied with alcohol and drugs in an attempt to take advantage? Something went wrong that night, whether it was intentional or accidental. We can't be sure. Either way, Kim's case has gone unsolved for far too long. Although this case hasn't been classified as a homicide, police do say that foul play is suspected. They know that people alive today hold the answers to what happened to Kim. If Rhonda were still alive, maybe she would have revealed that she knew something. No one knows if she did, but the opportunity is gone now. They just have to find that one key. Maybe that one missing piece of information that could help bring Kim home, to finally lay her to rest by her mother's side. If you have any information about the disappearance of Kimberly Moreau, please call 207-743-8282 or 1-800-THE-LOST. To follow Kim's case on social media, her sisters run a Facebook group called Kimberly Moreau Missing from J, Maine. That brings us to the end of episode 132. I'd like to thank everyone who helped out with this episode. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support The Vanished? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help the show is by supporting our sponsors. You can find the links and promo codes mentioned in the episode notes. And finally, another thing you can do is to fill out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Missouri. Thanks for listening.
And you just got to understand how much it impacts everybody around. I've had people down the road from me say that all of a sudden they weren't allowed to go walk the streets at night. Nobody knew if there was a killer lurking in the shadows. And people's other families wanted to know where their kids were all the time and what time they were going to be home and so forth. And not only did it affect us, but it affected others. I still, to this day, have people come, and I work at a hospital with public coming in all the time, and people will still ask me to this day, any news on your sister? I'm thinking of you guys. And people still remember. It's nice to know people care.
The state of Maine right now, in order to find out how many people, now this to me is ludicrous, but to find out how many people is actually missing in the state of Maine, you need to go to three different websites to find it, because there is no one central place where everybody reports. Their excuse for it is it would be an insult to ask the Portland Police Department or the Bangor Police Department to report all of their people that they've got missing cases on in one central area. And I'm saying that's kind of stupid, because one could be helping another. Now, we have done many searches. We have used dogs on information that we've had. I've gone in and actually cleaned out a whole swamp area over 60 feet wide and over 400 feet long, doing on information that we had received. To this point, it still has not ever produced anything that is positive to say that we have found human remains. But I certainly have learned a lot.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.